All right, so we spent the last 2 hours. We spent the last 2 hours talking about the receptors, where the receptors are located, how the receptors are activated or inhibited, right, where their mechanism of action are. Now the question is, okay, why is that all of important? Well, it's important when you look at the pharmacological side of stimulating and inhibiting various effector organs. Okay? And so now we're going to move into the pharm portion of our ANS. What happens when you give a drug? Well, it depends on what kind of a drug and what its effects on the receptors will be. And so again, refer you to my friend, the essential drug list. And these drugs are what you're going to be responsible for on the exam. Now, as you move through the lecture, you're going to notice that there are some drugs that are highlighted in blue and some that are highlighted in red. The drugs that are highlighted in red are the ones that are on this list that you're going to be responsible for the exam. Okay? The ones that are in blue, you're not responsible for on the exam. However, they are familial to those drugs that are required. And it also is interesting to note them because when you get to term five, you'll have to know them anyway. So it's also good to see what the familial drugs are. On the drug list, you'll see CA under the adrenergic drugs. That's catecholamine, not calcium. So just make a note of that, that the CA is going to mean catecholamine, not calcium. Okay? So let's get started with some of the drugs. All right. So we looked at the storage and the release of acetylcholine. Well, we know again from what we did earlier, your acetylcholine is from your acetyl-CoA and your choline. And your rate-limiting step, you get your release, and you get the breakdown of your acetylcholine in the synapse via your acetylcholine esterase. Okay? But you can have drugs that can interfere with this process. And you can have drugs that inhibit the reuptake of your choline via that sodium choline cotransporter. You can have drugs that interfere with the storage, so it doesn't like to sit in the vesicle. Or you can have drugs that are going to affect your receptor. Either they're going to agonize the receptor or antagonize the receptor. You can also have a drug that's going to interfere with the degradation of your acetylcholine. Or you can have a drug that blocks that calcium channel, therefore preventing the release of your acetylcholine. So there is various ways that the release or the effects of acetylcholine can be manipulated. So let's look at the drugs affecting storage and release. Well, you've got hemicholinium. Hemicholinium is going to prevent the reuptake of your choline. And so therefore, you cannot get the recycling and the reformation of your acetylcholine. Vesamecol is going to prevent your acetylcholine, once it's made, to be taken up into the vesicle via that acetylcholine H exchanger. You then have Botox. Now Botox, you know, you stick it in your forehead, what you're doing is you're actually paralyzing the muscles in that area. And Botox, what it does is it degrades the synaptobrevins, the snares, and doesn't allow for vesicular fusion to occur with the membrane, so you can't get the release of acetylcholine. You'll get the vesicle, but you can't get the release. And so, of course, it's used clinically to paralyze selected muscles that are excessively, you know, have excessive tone or focal dystonia. And it's used for unmasking Lambert-Eaton syndrome. So Botox is administered locally in a very small amount. And of course, we don't want to have systemic administration because then you'll get generalized muscle weakness and paralysis depending on how strong the dose is. So Botox is only supposed to be given low doses in a very localized area to paralyze those muscles. Additionally, you can have drugs that prevent the acetylcholinesterases from working. So it's preventing the breakdown of your acetylcholine to keep more acetylcholine in the synapse. Okay? And those are parasympathomimetic, which means what it's doing is it's trying to keep the acetylcholine available to bind the receptors to generate the parasympathetic response. And this is just talking a little bit about how Botox works. And of course, the Botox will prevent the fusion of the vesicle in the membrane. And so, of course, you don't get the release of acetylcholine, and then there's no communication between that and the skeletal muscle. And you get paralysis and death if you, if it's severe enough to prevent breathing. Now, our acetylcholine esterase inhibitors. Well, why would we want to block the breakdown of our acetylcholine in the synapse? Well, you can have one of two reasons. You've got myasthenia gravis. Do we know what myasthenia gravis is? Right. So we know it's an autoimmune disease where antibodies attack the nicotinic receptors on our neuromuscular junction. And so what happens is it binds to these receptors, and the receptors then get internalized. And so they're not available. And so what happens is as the days goes on, you'll find a person with myasthenia gravis, they get weaker and weaker. Their eyelids start to droop as the day progresses because the receptors are being more and more internalized. And so what you do is you give them an anti-acetylcholine esterase. That's going to keep acetylcholine available in the synapse. Because what happens is, let's put some numbers to it. Normally, they have 1,000 receptors. Now they only have 100. Well, they still have 100. And so what you want to do is get the concentration of acetylcholine high in the synapse so there'll be enough to bind that 100 and at least generate some response. You can have Lambert-Eaton. This is another autoimmune disease with Lambert-Eaton. And what it does is it has antibodies against the presynaptic calcium channels. And so you can't get acetylcholine release. And so, but what happens with Lambert-Eaton, and what's interesting about Lambert-Eaton, is that you have these vesicles, you have a number of quanta with acetylcholine ready for release. And so if you have rapid repetitive stimulation or a voluntary activation, it can aid in the release of the quanta. And so you'll see some generalized muscle weakness. And Botox, they say, can unmask this, because what happens is when you give Botox, you're giving it in a localized area. You're supposed to paralyze the muscle, and there's no vesicular binding. But if you have an underlying issue of Lambert-Eaton, what happens is when you give the Botox and then you stimulate, you still get very, very weak, generalized weakness. You still are able to get some release of your acetylcholine because of the underlying effect of your Lambert-Eaton. So you're still, with repetitive stimulation, able to release a very low amount of acetylcholine, even though with Botox, you're not supposed to see it. So with Botox, you're not supposed to see any response, but then you still are seeing some quanta that are able to get through, and you're experiencing generalized weakness in that area. Then the doctor's able to say, there's something else going on that's encouraging this generalized weakness. And so Botox is able to unmask that there is another underlying effect with this acetylcholine release, allowing for generalized weakness in the area where Botox should not allow for generalized weakness. And so when we look at anticholinesterases or anticholinesterase, anti-acetylcholinesterases, acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, several different ways you can say it. Got different kinds. First one is edrafonium. Edrafonium is used for diagnosis of myasthenia gravis and Lambert-Eaton. It has a very short half-life. And so what you do is you give edrafonium just to test and see if indeed this patient may have one of these autoimmune diseases. If the patient does have one of these autoimmune diseases, then you can treat with astigmine, neostigmine, physostigmine, pyridostigmine. Okay? And those stigmines are based on their half-lives, how severe the case is, right? And so you've got your physostigmine, pyridostigmine, they're the long lasting, not neostigmine. Those are longer lasting than your edrophonium. And so they're going to be used for treating your myasthenia gravis. And so what happens is that what they're going to do is they're going to block the breakdown of the acetylcholine. So you keep the acetylcholine in the synapse. And these anti-acetylcholine esterases are going to be very good reversing neuromuscular blockers. So if you have a blocker, you can competitively out-compete that blocker by having a lot more acetylcholine available to out-compete that blocker. Physostigmine is very good to combating atropine poisoning because it can cross the blood-brain barrier. And so with that, it's good if you have that type of poisoning. It won't affect the CNS. It won't have major side effects for that. And so basically what it's doing is you're hydrolyzing, you're forming covalent bonds, so you break down the ability for the acetylcholine esterase to work, keep the acetylcholine high concentrations in the synapse. You've also got parathione and malathione. Now, if you go to Ace or you go to Creative, you'll find malathione on the shelf. Malathione is a pesticide, very toxic, and this is an irreversible bonding. And you'll find there was an epidemic in Guyana in 1973, where there was a lot of suicides. Epidemic of suicides in Guyana with malathione. You'll find it in African countries. You've even found it in some farmers in the U.S. Because what happens is when you take malathione, it's an irreversible bonding. And so these phosphate groups are irreversibly binding to your acetylcholine esterase, is forming this very stable complex. And of course, that's going to prevent your acetylcholine from breaking down. The acetylcholine is going to stay in the synapse, and it's going to be available to bind your receptors. And if it stays and binds your receptors, now what you're doing is you're desensitizing your receptors, paralyzing your muscles, and eventually your respiratory muscles are going to give up and fail. And so the only way to overcome this is with drugs that are going to help synthesize new acetylcholine esterases, because this malathione is irreversible. The pyridostigmines, the stigmines are reversible. They'll bind, and that's it. But with the malathione now, these are irreversible. So the only way that you can gain function of your acetylcholine esterases is to generate new ones. And so that can take up to 6 weeks to 2 months to do. So why do we want these acetylcholine esterase inhibitors? Well, what you want to do is you want to increase your parasympathetic tone. So basically what you want is a parasympathomimetic. You want to trigger parasympathetic responses. You want your acetylcholine to bind your receptors. It's parasympathomimetic or sympatholytic, right? So you're cutting out the sympathetics, but you're upregulating the parasympathetics. And so what happens is you can help patients with glaucoma. You can decrease the intraocular pressure in the eye. You increase the outflow of the aqueous humor. And again, because your muscarinic receptors are very important in GI motility, if you increase the availability of acetylcholine to bind your muscarinic receptors, you can increase the motility in the GI tract, right? And again, you can outcompete. If you have a lot of acetylcholine, you can outcompete a receptor antagonist, right? Such as atropine. Atropine is going to antagonize your muscarinic receptor. If you outcompete it by giving acetylcholine, that will help alleviate those effects. You can have rivastigmine. Like, rivastigmine is important in dementia and Alzheimer's. So what it does is, in a titratable form, it delays the development of cognitive and functional impairment. So it delays it by 6 months. It doesn't cut it out, but it will delay it. Or you can reverse the paralysis from a non-depolarizing neuromuscular blocker. We're going to talk about pancuronium and succinylcholine in a little while. And those are what's used in surgery. When you want to intubate a patient, you have to relax their muscles so that you can get the tube down. And those are drugs that are used during surgery. And so when you have the use of pancuronium, you want to reverse those. You don't want to paralyze the muscle anymore. So you give them neostigmine or physostigmine that can then allow the acetylcholine to outcompete the drug that was given. So that can be used to reverse the competitive block. But what's the problem? What can possibly be a problem? If I've got too much acetylcholine, will it only just stimulate my neuromuscular junction? If I have a lot of acetylcholine that's floating around in my synapse, what else can it stimulate? Will it just only stimulate my nicotinic receptor in the neuromuscular junction? Will it? I'm hearing no. So what else can it stimulate? It can also do what? It stimulate, I heard ANS, yeah, but what? Okay, I hear parasympathetic, but what? What can it stimulate in my autonomic nervous system of the parasympathetic nervous system, of the autonomic nervous system? My postsynaptic receptor, which is? Can also be available to bind my muscarinic receptors. So if I have excessive acetylcholine floating around in the synapse, I could potentially now not only stimulate my nicotinic receptors and my muscles, but I can also, depending on how much this drug is stimulating acetylcholine, now stimulate muscarinic responses. And that means excessive salivation, excessive lacrimation, excessive pupillary constriction, diarrhea, bradycardia, right? Additionally, I can continue to excessively stimulate my nicotinic receptors and get muscle weakness and paralysis. If I've got way too much, I can do it on both sides. And this is what happens with chemical warfare, right? So this uses a nerve gas. So they use this acetylcholine just like the malathione, right? What it will do is it's going to cause your muscle weakness and paralysis, and then that can cause your respiratory muscles to fail. Yeah. So if you have acetylcholine, a lot of acetylcholine, if you have this drug that is blocking the breakdown of acetylcholine, you have a lot of acetylcholine available in the synapses. It can bind any receptor that will bind acetylcholine. So you can bind your nicotinics, it can bind your muscarinics, and generate side effects from excessive binding of those receptors, right? So again, you can have drugs that are agonists or antagonists to a particular receptor. So you can have the nicotinic agonist or antagonist or a muscarinic agonist or antagonist. So let's look at a muscarinic. So a classic muscarinic, that's an antagonist, we'll talk about that shortly, but the agonist, well, what do they want to do? So if I want to agonize my muscarinic, what's going to happen if I agonize muscarinic? What are some of the side effects that I expect to see? If I agonize my muscarinic receptors, what are some of the effects that I might see? I might see GI what? GI motility. What else might I see? Increased salivation. I'll get some lacrimation. I'll see bradycardia. My heart rate will go down. I would get hypotension. If I reduce my heart rate, that could contribute to hypotension. But if you're talking about through my blood vessels, would my parasympathetics affect the blood vessels? No. So the hypotension couldn't be caused through there, but it could be caused through the reduction in the heart rate, the back doorway. What else might I see? See some sweating. What else might I see? This side of the room is awfully quiet. What might I see if I agonize my M's? Bronchoconstriction. I'm like beating up my neck. All right? So there's a plethora of things that you can see if you give some agonists, right? Eyes, you can reduce the intraocular pressure and help reduce glaucoma. You can increase bladder. Again, we didn't talk the bladder. So what else would happen with the bladder if I trigger my muscarinic agonist? What's going to happen with my bladder? I'm going to get contraction, and I'll get to have micturition occurring. All right. So there's a particular drug called bethenecol. Bethenecol is a muscarinic agonist, and what happens is it increases the GI tract motility, and it helps patients regain the bladder, the ability to urinate and to defecate, and it's given to increase the GI tract and the urinary tract motility after surgery. That's bethenecol, and that's one on your list. So you'll see that coming up. And then you got the increase of salivation. So you have a different various amounts of things that can happen when you agonize your muscarinic receptors. So acetylcholine is not a good agonist for if you want long-term effects. It has a very short half-life. So you have a lot of drugs that are going to mimic those effects. Carbachol, it's a derivative of acetylcholine, but it has an affinity to both the neuromuscular junction nicotinic receptor and the muscarinic receptor. So that could be problematic because it has no selection. It will bind either one of those types of receptors. And so because of that, it's not really used systemically because it binds pretty much all the receptors. So it's not necessarily a good drug to use. But pilocarpine is similar to muscarine, and muscarine, of course, is an agonist. And it's used clinically to treat glaucoma, so it's draining the aqueous humor, and it's also used to increase salivation in those patients who experience dry mouth and Sjögren syndrome. Methacholine is more resistant to breakdown by the acetylcholine esterase, so it allows for your acetylcholine to stay longer. And what's good about the methacholine is that it has little affinity for the nicotinic receptor, so it's looking straight at agonizing your muscarinic receptors. And this is an interesting drug because they use it in patients to see if a patient has asthma. And so asthmatics are going to be more sensitive to the methacholine. And I assume that they would, because what happens is if you give this muscarinic agonist to an asthmatic, what do you expect is going to happen to this patient? Their throat is going to bronchoconstrict a lot faster. So you give a very low dose to this patient, and they're going to be very much more sensitive to a very low dose. And so you can tell right off the bat whether this patient is normal or is asthmatic based on that very low dose response. Bethenecol, we just spoke about that. Bethenecol is selective only for muscarinic receptors. Choice for helping to promote GI and urinary tract motility, particularly after surgery or postpartum. Okay. All right, so you have a 32-year-old woman. She has myasthenia gravis, and she's been prescribed physostigmine. So we know what physostigmine is. What is physostigmine? What is physostigmine? Is it a muscarinic agonist? No, physostigmine is acetylcholine esterase inhibitor. Good. So it's an anti-acetylcholine esterase. So then what's that telling you? That's telling you what's going on now in their system. increased levels of acetylcholine. All right. So she comes back and she's got diarrhea, abdominal cramps, and salivation. Okay. So what's causing the diarrhea, abdominal cramps, and the salivation? The acetylcholine binding to her muscarinic receptors. So on examination, her heart rate is 50 BPMs. That high or low? Very low. So we know that the acetylcholine is definitely stimulating her muscarinic receptors because she's bradycardic. Which of the following now would most likely alleviate these side effects that she's presenting with? So what would you want to give her? Oh. You want to give her a muscarinic antagonist. Okay. So all these effects that she's experiencing is because the acetylcholine is stimulating her muscarinic receptors, so you want to block those responses and give her an antagonist. And so we move into our next topic of the antagonists. These are parasympatholytics, meaning they want to cut out the parasympathetic responses. So they're sympathomimetic, so they want to generate some sympathetic-like responses. And so they're going to bind to the muscarinic receptors and prevent the acetylcholine from exerting its effect. So it's a competitive antagonist. Okay? And so sympathetic now responses are going to predominate. Right? And atropine is the classic muscarinic antagonist. And so when it binds to your muscarinic receptors, you're going to find all the effects are opposite to the parasympathetic effects. So you're going to see a pupil dilating. You're going to see tachycardia, reduced secretions. You're going to see sympathetic responses because what you're doing is you're antagonizing the parasympathetics, generating sympathetic responses. So clinically, you will use atropine. So you know when you go to the eye doctor and they say they want to check your eye and they drop this stuff in your eye and it feels sticky and it's nasty and your eyes are stuck open? That's atropine, what they're dropping on your eye. And so it's applied topically for the ophthalmology to examine your eyes. So it produces your mydriasis. It's not dilating your pupils. It's going to inhibit excessive salivation. It's going to inhibit or counteract muscarine poisoning. So now it's going to help competitively outdo the muscarinic poisoning. Reduces GI motility, tone. Now you're looking at some sympathetic activities coming up. Okay, so you will see the reduction in bladder motility. You'll see the reduction in sweating. So it's going to block your M receptors all around. And so atropine is going to reduce all the following. And this is a sludge mnemonic. It's going to reduce salivation. It's going to reduce lacrimation. It's going to reduce urination and diaphoresis and GI motility and emesis. Okay? So basically what it's doing is bringing down the parasympathetics, antagonizing your parasympathetics, and allowing for sympathetic responses to occur. So you've got several different drugs. You've got scopolamine. Scopolamine is used for motion sickness. You can go into the pharmacy here, True Blue, and get one over the counter. What's the more common form of scopolamine? I heard it, Dramamine. So Dramamine is part of the atropine scopolamine family. Okay. And so scopolamine was used as a truth drug in the 50s and 60s as a general depressant. Okay. And then you have pirenzepine. This is used to treat ulcers. And ipratropium. Now this ipratropium is selective for M3s. And so what it's going to do is it's going to reduce bronchial secretions used in COPD. So it's going to help to bronchodilate. Okay. So again, they can use this in asthmatics as well as those in patients with COPD. All right, so what do we got? We have a five-year-old boy. His mom takes him to the emergency room. He was eating berries from her garden. The child is tachycardic. Body temperature has gone up. His pupils are dilated. So what is probably causing this child's symptoms? Well, first things first, you got to look and think about what is causing. What can cause this child's heart to become tachycardic? What do you think can stimulate this child's heart to become tachycardic? We can do stimulation of beta 1s, okay? Or inhibit muscarinics, okay? It's a thought. What could dilate this child's pupils? What could dilate the child's pupils? What's pupillary dilation? Mydriasis. What can cause that? We can have stimulation of? We can have stimulation of? My front row is doing really well, but I want to hear from further back. Yeah. I hear you. I got you. What can dilate this child's eyes? My? Sympathetic. Okay, yes, but what through sympathetic? Which one? My alpha 1s, right? So I can dilate the child's pupil through alpha 1s, or? All right, so we'll stick with alpha 1s for now. So you told me that the child can be tachycardic if I stimulate beta 1. You tell me his pupils can be dilated by stimulating alpha 1s, and his body temperature is up. What can cause his body temperature to go up? Do you think this berry is stimulating sympathetics? Who says yes? Let me just see hands. Yes? Who thinks this berry is stimulating parasympathetics? Doesn't stimulate your parasympathetic. It's inhibiting the parasympathetics. Okay, so what you're seeing are sympathetic symptoms, responses, right? But what's key here, the actual answer to the question that should guide you to what's really happening with this child is the raised body temperature. But before we even get there, you told me that tachycardia could be an increased stimulation of beta 1s, and you told me the pupils are going to be stimulation of alpha 1s. Now, I doubt there's a berry that's going to be able to trigger two different type of receptors, an alpha and a beta. But the key to answering this question is the raised body temperature. If the child's body temperature is raised, what's happening to his sweat response? It's been inhibited. And we know his sweat response is triggered by the stimulation of which receptor? We know the sweating response is stimulated by which receptor? Are muscarinic. So if the child is not sweating and his body temperature is going up, that's telling you his M is inhibited. And so that's a very key leader or lead-in to what you rightly discerned, that there was the inhibition of his M receptors. His sweating response is locked off, which means his M's are inhibited. Now, if I inhibit the M receptor, what would happen to his heart? He'd be tachycardic. If I block the M receptors on the pupils, he'd give me dilation. So in this case, what would his berries have possibly been made of? Which drug component would his berries be made of? A muscarinic antagonist, and it probably was atropine. Good. questions? So even though you see some sympathetic responses, those sympathetic responses were because you had antagonized the parasympathetic response. All right, next one. Aww. Who just, aww? You don't like my questions? Oh, you missed this one before. Okay. All right. Got this woman. She's recovering from surgery. She can't urinate. She's constipated. So the doctor gives her bethenacol. And what type of drug is bethenacol? What classification of drug is bethenacol? A muscarinic agonist. So if it's an agonist, what would you not expect her to see? Would you expect to see bronchoconstriction in her? If it's a muscarinic agonist, would you expect to see bronchoconstriction? Yeah. Would you expect to see salivation? Yeah. Would you expect to see bradycardia? Yes. Would you expect to see increased body temperature? No. Right? If it's an M agonist, what would you expect to see relative to her body temperature? You would expect to see excessive sweating, so her body temperature would go down. And meiosis, would you expect to see that? Yes. So the answer to the question would be increased body temperature. Everything else is triggered by an M. Everything else is triggered by M. Okay. All right. Let's move into succinylcholine versus pancuronium. You got a patient on the table. You have a surgery, but this patient needs to be intubated. And for a good long length of the surgery, you need this patient to stay intubated. So what do? Well, you can give one of two drugs. You can give either succinylcholine or you can give pancuronium. Well, which one do you give? Well, it depends on a few things. It depends on the length of the surgery, right? You've got two different kinds of drugs that will do exactly the same thing but by two completely different mechanisms. So the first one is succinylcholine. Now, succinylcholine is considered to be a nicotinic receptor depolarizing blockade. And what happens is succinylcholine acts as an agonist, and what it does is it desensitizes your nicotinic receptor. So what happens is when succinylcholine is given, it will open up the nicotinic receptor on the neuromuscular junction, and it will keep it open. And so it will show depolarization will happen, and then what will be generated is a depolarization blockade. So you get prolonged activation by the agonist on the receptor. And eventually what happens is, with the persistent stimulation of these nicotinic receptors, is that they remain in a depolarized state and can't return to a resting state. So the muscle will contract initially, because you're triggering the muscle to contract, but then the contractions become weaker and weaker and weaker until the muscle actually becomes flaccid, and then you have paralysis of the muscle. And so the succinylcholine works by keeping the muscles from contracting. So it's over-contracting that muscle until eventually it just becomes flaccid and paralyzed. And so, again, you'll get desensitization of the receptor, which is going to cause the muscle paralysis. And you'll use this for intubation and if you need to ventilate your patient. And it's a depolarizing blockade because it's agonizing, it's stimulating the receptor to stay open. and it's depolarizing until the contractions get weaker until the muscles actually become paralyzed. Now, there's some side effects and adverse reactions. You can get bradycardia. You get a lot of potassium released from prolonged depolarization, prolonged paralysis. And in some patients, you can develop malignant hyperthermia, and that's a rare genetic disease that's in response to some of these anesthetics. And then that can cause their inability, overwhelm the body with oxygen and removal of carbon dioxide, and can cause the patient to go into circulatory collapse. On the flip side, you've got pancuronium. Pancuronium is a non-depolarizing blocker, otherwise known as a nicotinic receptor antagonist, right? What it does is it's going to block the receptor from opening. And so it's going to again be used to relax the skeletal muscles during surgery to allow for intubation and ventilation. But the action is different. It's going to occupy your nicotinic receptor. It has no intrinsic activity. It's blocking the receptor from doing anything. And it's preventing acetylcholine from binding. And so the muscles can't contract. And so the muscles become paralyzed. So if the succinylcholine desensitizes the receptors, it causes the receptor to open, binds the receptor, causes the receptor to open up and depolarizes until it gets too weak. But the pancuronium, or the non-depolarizing blocker, blocks the receptor from the acetylcholine from binding. And so what happens is the acetylcholine can't bind, the receptor can't respond, and the muscle can't contract, and it becomes paralyzed. Now, if I gave acetylcholine to a patient that had succinylcholine, would that help my patient? If a patient was given succinylcholine, and then I gave acetylcholine to that patient, would that help? Would giving acetylcholine to a patient that has been given succinylcholine, will that help them? Yes? No? No? Why? No. Because it's? Because why? They are agonized and it's desensitized. So if I give acetylcholine, what will that do to my receptor? If I give acetylcholine, what would happen to my receptor? It's already open, right? So what would happen to my patient? The receptors are already open. I give acetylcholine. So what would happen to my patient? Nothing. But if I gave the patient pancuronium, then I gave them acetylcholine, what would happen to that patient? Would that help their paralysis? Would it? If I gave my patient pancuronium, which is a non-depolarizing blocker, and then I gave them acetylcholine, would that help my patient? Would that continue to make them paralyzed or undo the paralysis? It would undo the paralysis. If I gave my patient succinylcholine and then gave them acetylcholine, would that help the paralysis or make it worse? It would make it worse, right? Non-depolarizing blockers, they're competitive. So if you give acetylcholine, it can outcompete it. But succinylcholine is not a competitive blocker. So if you give acetylcholine, what you're going to be doing is exacerbating the problem, because succinylcholine stimulates the receptor, acetylcholine will stimulate the receptor, and the muscle will remain paralyzed. But if you have pancuronium, which is a blocker, you give acetylcholine, it can outcompete the blocker and reverse the effects. So pancuronium, vecuronium, mivacurium, they're all from the same family, only difference is the length of how long they act, right? And so pancuronium is more longer acting. And they're more selective, again, which is important, because you want them to be selective towards your nicotinic receptors on the neuromuscular junction, not in the ganglia. Okay? And of course, it's going to induce flaccid paralysis in the surgery. But there are side effects like anything else: bronchospasm, salivation, apnea, respiratory failure. So here is a nice little chart that compares the two, right? You've got your depolarizing blocker succinylcholine. It's going to activate your nicotinic receptor, paralyzing the muscle. Now, you'll use that one if you only need a few minutes of paralysis. But pancuronium is a non-depolarizing blocker. It's going to block the receptor, and you get muscle paralysis. And this is the one you'll use if your surgery is running an extended period of time, right? So you use succinylcholine and depolarize the receptor for short procedures, but you want to block the receptor when you're using longer surgical procedures. So if I give acetylcholine to a person that has succinylcholine and the receptor is already depolarized, activated, acetylcholine is going to make it worse. But if I give acetylcholine to a patient that has this blocking pancuronium, the paralyzing effects can be overcome by having a lot more acetylcholine. And so a good drug to give to allow for an increased concentration of acetylcholine could be what? A drug that can help increase the concentration of acetylcholine to overcome these effects could be what? Which one? Acetylcholine esterase inhibitor, which could be which ones? Neostigmine, physostigmine, or pyridostigmine. It could be any of the stigmines, right? So you give them an anticholinesterase inhibitor to increase the concentration of acetylcholine to outcompete your pancuronium. All right, so succinylcholine will cause paralysis because how does it work? What does it do? It depolarizes your end plate. All right, so I will leave you here and I will see you tomorrow.